This was a ballroom, still plush in red and gold, but musty in the semi-darkness and ghostly with its shrouded chandeliers. The candlelight in the centre was dimly reflected from the mirrors around the walls. They had probably once brightened the place up considerably, but over the years some sort of curious tarnish had blotched its way across them, so that the reflections of the candles looked like dim subaqueous glows through a forest of seaweed. Mr. Pin was halfway across the floor when he realised that the only footsteps he could hear were his own. Mr. Tulip had veered off in the gloom and was dragging the shroud off something that had been pushed against one wall.
"Well, I'll be a—" the man began. "It's a ing treasure, or thought so. A genuine ing intaglio Ernesto, too. See that mother-of-pearl work there?"
"This isn't the time, Mr. Tulip."
"He only made six of them. Oh, no, they haven't even kept it ing-tuned."
"God damn it, we're supposed to be professionals."
"Perhaps your colleague would like it as a present," said a voice from the centre of the room.
There were half a dozen chairs around the circle of candlelight. They were an old-fashioned kind, and the backs curved out and up to form a deep, leathery arch that had presumably been designed to keep out the draughts, but now gave the occupants their own deep pools of shadow. Mr. Pin had been here before. He'd admired the setup. Anyone inside the ring of candles couldn't see who was in the depths of the chairs, while at the same time being fully visible themselves. It occurred to him now that the arrangement also meant that the people in the chairs couldn't see who was in the other chairs. Mr. Pin was a rat. He was quite happy with the description. Rats had a lot to recommend them, and this layout had been dreamed up by someone who thought like him. One of the chairs said,
"Your friend Daffodil."
"Tulip," said Mr. Pin.
"Your friend Mr. Tulip would perhaps like part of your payment to be the harpsichord," said the chair. "It's not a ing harpsichord, it's a ing virginal," growled Mr. Tulip. "One ing string to a note instead of two. So called because it was an instrument for ing young ladies."
"My word, was it?" said one of the chairs. "I thought it was just a sort of early piano." "Intended to be played by young ladies," said Mr. Pin smoothly. "And Mr. Tulip does not collect art. He merely appreciates it. Our payment will be in gems as agreed."
"As you wish. Please step into the circle."
"Ing harpsichord," muttered Mr. Tulip.
The new firm came under the hidden gaze of the chairs as they took up their positions. What the chairs saw was this. Mr. Pin was small and slim and, like his namesake, slightly larger in the head than ought to be the case. If there was a word for him, apart from rat, it was dapper. He drank little, he watched what he ate, and considered that his body, slightly malformed though it was a temple. He also used too much oil on his hair and parted it in the middle in a way that was 20 years out of style, and his black suit was on the greasy side, and his little eyes were constantly moving, taking in everything. It was hard to see Mr. Tulip's eyes because of the certain puffiness, probably caused by too much enthusiasm for things in bags. Your brain on drugs is a terrible sight, but Mr. Tulip was living proof of the fact that so was your brain on a cocktail of horse liniment, sherbet and powdered water retention pills. The bags had also possibly caused the general blotchiness and the thick veins that stood out on his forehead, but Mr. Tulip was in any case the kind of heavy-set man who is on the verge of bursting out of his clothes, and despite his artistic inclinations, projected the image of a would-be wrestler who had failed the intelligence test. If his body was a temple, it was one of those strange ones where people did odd things to animals in the basement, and if he watched what he ate, it was only to see it wriggle. Several of the chairs wondered not if they were doing the right thing, since that was indisputable, but whether they were doing it with the right people. Mr. Tulip, after all, wasn't a man you'd want to see standing too close to a naked flame.
"When will you be ready?" said a chair. "How is your protégé today?"
"We think Tuesday morning would be a good time," said Mr. Pin. "By then he'll be as good as he's going to get."
"And there will be no deaths involved," said a chair. "This is important."
"Mr. Tulip will be as gentle as a lamb," said Mr. Pin. Unseen gazes avoided the sight of Mr. Tulip, who had chosen this moment to suck up his nose a large quantity of slab.
"Yes," said a chair. "His lordship is not to be harmed in any more than is strictly necessary. Vetinari dead would be more dangerous than Vetinari alive. And at all costs, there must be no trouble with the watch.
Yeah, we know about the watch, said Mr. Pin. Mr. Slant told us.
Commander Vimes is running a very efficient watch.
No problem, said Mr. Pin.
And it employs a werewolf.
White powder fountained into the air. Mr. Pin had to slap his colleague on the back.
Werewolf? Are you in crazy? Why does your partner keep saying ing, Mr. Pin?
Said a chair.
You must be out of your ing minds, Tulip growled.
A speech impediment, said Pin.
A werewolf? Thank you for telling us. Thank you very much. They're worse than vampires when they're on the trail. You do know that, do you? You were recommended to us as men of resource.
Expensive men of resource, said Mr. Pin. A chair sighed.
There are seldom any other kind. Very well, very well. Mr. Slant will discuss this with you.
Yeah, but they've got a sense of smell that you wouldn't believe, Mr. Tulip went on. Money's no use to a ing dead man.
Are there any other surprises? Said Mr. Pin. You've got bright watchmen, and one of them's a werewolf. Anything else? They've got trolls, too?
Oh, yes, several. And dwarfs and zombies.
In a watch? What kind of city are you running here?
We are not running the city, said a chair.
But we care about the way it is going, said another.
Ah, said Mr. Pin.
Right, I remember. You are concerned citizens.
He knew about concerned citizens. Wherever they were, they all spoke the same private language, where traditional values meant hang someone. He did not have a problem with this, broadly speaking, but it never hurt to understand your employer.
You could have got someone else, he said. You've got a guild of assassins here.
A chair made a sucking sound between its teeth.
The trouble with the city at present, it said, is that a number of otherwise intelligent people find the status quo convenient, even though it will undoubtedly ruin the city.
Ah, said Mr. Pin, they are unconcerned citizens.
Precisely, gentlemen.
There's a lot of them? The chair ignored this.
We look forward to seeing you again, gentlemen, tomorrow night, when I trust you will announce your readiness. Good evening.
The circle of chairs was silent for a while after the new firm had left. Then a black-clad figure entered soundlessly through the big doors, approached the light, nodded and hurried away.
They're well outside the building, said a chair.
What ghastly people!
We shall have used the Assassin's Guild, though.
Ha! They've done rather well out of Vetinari. In any case, we do not want him dead. However, it occurs to me that we may eventually have a job for the guild later on.
Quite so. When our friends have safely left the city, the roads can be so dangerous at this time of year.
No, gentlemen, we will stick to our plan. The one called Charlie will be kept around until everything is entirely settled, in case he can be of further use. And then our gentleman will take him a long, long way away to pay him off. Perhaps later we will call the assassins in, just in case Mr. Pin has any clever ideas.
Good point, although it does seem such a waste. The things one could do with Charlie.
I told you it would not work. The man is a clown.
I suppose you're right. Better something once and for all, then.
I'm sure we understand one another. And now, this meeting of the committee to unselect the patrician is declared closed, and hasn't happened.
Lord Vetinari by habit rose so early that bedtime was merely an excuse to change his clothes. He liked the time just before a winter's dawn. It was generally foggy, which made it hard to see the city, and for a few hours there was no sound but the occasional brief scream. But the tranquillity was broken this morning by a cry just outside the palace gates.
Oinari, zap!
He went to the window.
Squared up head, oit!
The patrician walked back to his desk and rang the bell for his clerk, Drumknot, who was dispatched to the walls to investigate.
It's the beggar known as Foul Old Ron, sir,
Drumknot reported 5 minutes later.
Selling this paper full of things.
He held it between two fingers, as though expecting it to explode. Lord Vetinari took it and read through it. Then he read through it again. "Well, well," he said. "The Ankh Morpork Times. Was anyone else buying this?"
"A number of people, my lord. People coming off the night shifts, market people, and so on."
"I see no mention of Hoinari Lap or Squidoped Oit."
"No, my lord."
"How very strange." Lord Vetinari read for a moment and said, "Clear my appointments this morning, will you? I will see the Guild of Town Criers at 9 o'clock and the Guild of Engravers at 10 past.
"I wasn't aware they had appointments, sir."
"They will have," said Lord Vetinari. "When they see this, they will have." "Well, well. I see 56 people were hurt in a tavern brawl."
"That seems rather a lot, my lord."
"It must be true, Drumknot," said the patrician. "It's in the paper. Oh, and send a message to that nice Mr. De Word, too. I will see him at 9:30. He ran his eye down the grey type again. "And please also put out the word that I wish to see no harm coming to Mr. De Word, will you?" Drumknot, usually so adept in his understanding of his master's requirements, hesitated a moment.
"My lord, do you mean that you want no harm to come to Mr. De Word, or that you want no harm to come to Mr. De Word?"
"Did you wink at me, Drumknot?"
"No, sir."
"Drumknot, I believe it is the right of every citizen of Ankh Morpork to walk the streets unmolested."
"Good God, sir, is it?"
"Indeed."
"But I thought you were very much against movable type, sir. You said it would make printing too cheap and people would..."
"Chinari lap!"
shouted the newspaper seller down by the gates. "Are you poised for the exciting new millennium that lies before us, Drumknot? Are you ready to grasp the future with a willing hand?"
"I don't know, my lord. Is special clothing required?"
The other lodgers were already at the breakfast table when William hurried down. He was hurrying because Mrs. Arcanum had views about people who were late for meals. Mrs. Arcanum, proprietress of Mrs. Eucrasia Arcanum's lodging house for respectable working men, was what Saccharissa was unconsciously training to be. She wasn't just respectable. She was respectable. It was a lifestyle, religion and hobby combined. She liked respectable people who were clean and decent. She used the phrase as if it was impossible to be one without being the other. She kept respectable beds and cooked cheap but respectable meals for her respectable lodgers, who, apart from William, were mostly middle-aged, unmarried and extremely sober. They were mainly craftsmen in small trades and were almost all heavily built, well-scrubbed, owned serious boots and were clumsily polite at the dining table. Oddly enough, or at least oddly enough to William's expectations of people like Mrs. Arcanum, she wasn't averse to dwarfs and trolls, at least the clean and decent ones. Mrs. Arcanum rated decency above species.
"It says here 56 people were hurt in a brawl," said Mr. Mackleduff, who, by dint of being the longest surviving lodger, acted as a kind of president at meal times.
He had bought a copy of the Times on his way home from the bakery, where he was night shift foreman.
"Fancy," said Mrs. Arcanum.
"I think it must have been 5 or 6, said William.
"It says 56 here," said Mr. Mackleduff sternly, "in black and white."
"It must be right," said Mrs. Arcanum, to general agreement. "Otherwise they wouldn't let them put it in."
"I wonder who's doing it," said Mr. Prone, who travelled in wholesale boots and shoes.
"Oh, they be special people for doing this," said Mr. Mackleduff.
"Really?" said William.
"Oh, yes," said Mr. Mackleduff,
who was one of those large men who are instantly expert on anything.
"They wouldn't allow just anyone to write what they like. It stands to reason."
So it was in a thoughtful mood that William made his way to the shed behind the bucket. Good Mountain looked up from the stone where he was carefully setting the type for a playbill.
"There's a spot of cash for you over there," he said, nodding to a bench.
It was mostly in coppers. It was almost $30. William stared at it.
"This can't be right," he whispered.
"Mr. Ron and his friends kept coming back for more," said Good Mountain.
But it was only usual stuff," said William. "It wasn't even anything of very importance, just stuff that happened."
"Ah, well, people like to know about stuff that happened," said the dwarf. "And I reckon we can sell 3 times as many tomorrow if we halve the price."
"Halve the price?"
"People like to be in the know. Just a thought." The dwarf grinned again. "There's a young lady in the back room."
In the days when this place had been a laundry, back in the pre-rocking horse age, one area had been partitioned off with some cheap panelling to waist height, to segregate the clerks and the person whose job it was to explain to customers where their socks had gone. Saccharissa was sitting primly on a stool, clutching her handbag to her with her elbows close to her sides in order to expose herself to as little of the grime as possible. She gave him a nod. Now, why had he asked her to come along? Oh, yes, she was sensible, more or less, and did her grandfather's books, and frankly, William didn't meet many literate people. He met the sort to whom a pen was a piece of difficult machinery. If she knew what an apostrophe was, he could put up with the fact that she acted as if she was living in a previous century.
"Is this your office now?" she whispered.
"I suppose so."
"You didn't tell me about the dwarfs."
"Do you mind?"
"Oh, no. Dwarfs are very law-abiding and respectable in my experience."
William now realised that he was talking to a girl who had never been in certain streets when the bars were closing.
"I've already got two good items for you," Saccharissa went on, as if imparting state secrets.
Yes?"
"My grandfather says this is the longest, coldest winter he can remember."
"Yes?"
"Well, he's 80. That's a long time."
"Oh.
And the meeting of the Dolly Sisters' Baking and Flower Circle annual competition had to be abandoned last night because the cake table got knocked over. I found out all about it from the secretary, and I've written it all down neatly."
Is that really interesting, do you think?" She handed him a page torn from a cheap exercise book. He read, "The Dolly Sisters Baking and Flower Circle annual competition was held in the reading room in Lobin Clout Street, Dolly Sisters. Mrs. H. Rivers was the president. She welcomed all members and commented on the sumptuous offerings. Prizes were awarded as follows." William ran his eye down the meticulous list of names and awards.
"Specimen in jar?" he queried. "Oh, that was the competition for dahlias," said Saccharissa.
William carefully inserted the word dahlia after the word specimen and read on.
"A fine display of loose stool covers."
"Well?" "Oh, nothing." William carefully changed this to loose covers for stools, which was barely an improvement, and continued to read with the air of a jungle explorer who might expect any kind of exotic beast to spring out of the peaceful undergrowth. The story concluded, "However, everyone's spirits were dampened when a naked man, hotly pursued by members of the watch, burst through the window and ran around the room, causing much disarray of the tarts before being apprehended by the trifles. The meeting closed at 9 p.m. Mrs. Rivers thanked all members."
"What do you think?" said Saccharissa, with just a hint of nervousness.
"You know," said William, in a sort of distant voice, "I think it is quite likely that it would be impossible to improve this piece in any way. What would you say was the most important thing that happened at the meeting?" Her hand flew to her mouth in dismay.
"Oh, yes, I forgot to put that in. Mrs. Flatter won first prize for her sponge. She's been runner-up for 6 years, too."
William stared at the wall. "Well done," he said. "I should put that in if I was you. But you could drop in at the watch house in Dolly Sisters and ask about the naked man."
"I shall do no such thing. Respectable women don't have anything to do with the watch."
"I meant, ask why he was being chased, of course."
"But why should I do that?"
William tried to put words around a vague idea. "People will want to know," he said.
"But won't the watch mind me asking?"
"Well, they're our watch. I don't see why they should. And perhaps you could find some more really old people to ask about the weather. Who is the oldest inhabitant in the city?"
"I don't know. One of the wizards, I expect."
"Could you go to the university and ask him if he remembers it ever being colder than this?"
"Is this where youth put things in the paper?" said a voice at the doorway.
It belonged to a small man with a beaming red face, one of those people blessed with the permanent expression of someone who has just heard a rather saucy joke.
"Only I grew this carrot," he went on, "and I reckon it's grown into a very interesting shape, eh? What do you think, eh? Talk about a giggle, eh? I took it down the pub and everyone was killing themselves. They said I should put it in your paper."
He held it aloft. It was a very interesting shape. And William went a very interesting shade.
"That's a very strange carrot," said Saccharissa, eyeing it critically. "What do you think, Mr. De Word?"
You go along to the university, why don't you, and I'll see to this gentleman," said William, when he felt he could speak again. "My wife couldn't stop laughing."
"What a lucky man you are, sir," said William solemnly.
"It's a shame you can't put pictures in your paper, eh?"
"Yes, but I think I may be in enough trouble already," said William, opening his notebook. When the man and his hilarious vegetable had been dealt with, William wandered out into the printing shop. The dwarfs were talking in a group around a trapdoor in the floor. "Pump's frozen again," said Goodmountain. "Can't mix up any more ink. Old man Cheese says there used to be a well somewhere around here." There was a shout from below. A couple of dwarfs descended the ladder. "Mr. Goodmountain, can you think of any reason I should put this in the paper?" said William, handing him Saccharissa's report of the flowers and cookery meeting. "It's a bit dull." The dwarf read the copy. "There's 73 reasons," he said. "That's 'cause there's 73 names. I expect people like to see their names in the paper. But what about the naked man?" "Yeah. Shame she didn't get his name." There was another shout from below. "Shall we have a look?" said Goodmountain. To William's complete lack of surprise, the little cellar under the shed was much better built than the shed itself. But then, practically everywhere in Ankh-Morpork had cellars that were once the first or even second or third floors of ancient buildings, built at the time of one of the city's empires, when men thought the future was going to last forever. And then the river had flooded and brought mud with it, and walls had gone higher, and now what Ankh-Morpork was built on was mostly Ankh-Morpork. People said that anyone with a good sense of direction and a pickaxe could cross the city underground by simply knocking holes in walls. Rusted tins and piles of timber rotted to tissue strength were piled up against one wall, and in the middle of the wall was a bricked-up doorway, the more recent bricks already looking worn and tatty compared to the ancient stone surrounding them.
"What's through there?" said Bodney.
"The old street, probably," said William.
"The street has a cellar. What does it keep there?"
"Oh, when parts of the city get badly flooded, people just keep building on up," said William. "This was probably a ground-floor room once, you see. People just bricked up the doors and windows and built on another story. In some parts of the city, they say, there's 6 or 7 levels underground, mostly full of mud, and that's choosing my words with care."
"I'm looking for Mr. William de Word," rumbled a voice above them.
An enormous troll was blocking out the light from the cellar trapdoor.
"That's me," said William.
"The patrician will see you now," said the troll.
"I don't have an appointment with Lord Veterinari."
"I will," said the troll. "You'd be amazed at how many people has appointments with the patrician and they don't know it. So you'd better hurry." "I would hurry if I was you."
There was no sound but the ticking of the clock. William watched in apprehension as, apparently forgetting his presence, Lord Veterinari read his way through the Times again. "What a very interesting document," said the patrician, suddenly laying it aside. "But I'm forced to ask why." "It's just my news sheet," said William. "But bigger. People like to know things."
"Which people?"
"Well, everyone, really."
"Do they?
Did they tell you this?" William swallowed. "Well, no, but you know I've been writing my newsletter for some time now."
"For various foreign notables and similar people," Lord Veterinari nodded. "People who need to know. Knowing things is part of their profession. But you are selling this to anyone in the street, is that correct?"
"I suppose so, sir."
"Interesting.
Then you wouldn't entertain the idea, would you, that a state is, say, rather like one of those old rowing galleys? The ones which had banks of oarsmen down below, and a helmsman and so on above. It is certainly in everyone's interest that the ship does not founder. But I put it to you, it is perhaps not in the interest of the rowers that they should know of every shoal avoided, every collision fended off. It would only serve to worry them and put them off their stroke. What the rowers need to know is how to row,
"And that the helmsman is a good one," said William.
He couldn't stop the sentence. It said itself. It was out there, hanging in the air. Lord Veterinari gave him a stare that went on for several seconds beyond the necessary time. Then his face instantly broke into a broad smile.
"To be sure. And so they should, so they should. This is the age of words, after all. 56 hurt in tavern brawl, eh? Astounding. What further news do you have for us, sir?"
"Well, it's been very cold."
"Has it? Has it indeed, my word?"
On his desk, the tiny iceberg bumped against the side of Lord Veterinari's inkwell.
"Yes, and there was a bit of a fracas at some cookery meeting last night."
"A fracas, eh?"
"Well,
probably more of a rumpus, really. Words resemble fish, in that some specialist ones can survive only in a kind of reef, where their curious shapes and usages are protected from the hurly-burly of the open sea. Rumpus and fracas are found only in certain newspapers, in much the same way that beverages are found only in certain menus. They are never used in normal conversation. Well, probably more of a rumpus, really, and somebody has grown a funny-shaped vegetable. That's the stuff. What shape? An amusing shape, sir. Could I give you a little bit of advice, Mr. De Word? Please do, sir. Be careful. People like to be told what they already know. Remember that. They get uncomfortable when you tell them new things. New things... Well, new things aren't what they expect. They like to know that, say, a dog will bite a man. That is what dogs do. They don't want to know that a man bites a dog, because the world is not supposed to happen like that. In short, what people think they want is news, but what they really crave is olds. I can see you've got the hang of it already. Yes, sir, said William, not at all sure he fully understood this, but certain that he didn't like the bit he did understand. I believe the Guild of Engravers has some things it wishes to discuss with Mr. Goodmountain, William, but I have always thought that we should go forward to the future. Yes, sir, quite hard to go any other way. Once again there was the too long stare, and then the sudden unfreezing of the face. Indeed. Good day, Mr. De Word. Oh, and do tread carefully. I'm sure you wouldn't want to become news, would you? William turned over the patrician's words as he walked back to Gleam Street, and it is not wise to be thinking too deeply when walking the streets of Ankh-Morpork. He walked past Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler with barely a nod, but in any case Mr. Dibbler was otherwise engaged. He had two customers. Two at once, unless one was daring another, was a great rarity. But these two were worrying him. They were inspecting the merchandise. C.M.O.T. Dibbler sold his buns and pies all around the city, even outside the Assassin's Guild. He was a good judge of people, especially when it involved judging when to step innocently round a corner and then run like hell. And he had just decided that he was really unlucky to be standing here, and also that it was too late. He didn't often meet killers. Murderers, yes, but murderers usually had some strange reason, and in any case generally murdered friends and relations. And he'd met plenty of assassins. But assassination had a certain style, and even certain rules. These men were killers. The big one, with the powdery streaks down his jacket and the smell of mothballs, was just a vicious thug, no problem there. But the small one with the lank hair had the smell of violent and spiteful death about him. You didn't often look into the eyes of someone who'd kill because it seemed like a good idea at the time. Moving his hands carefully, Dibbler opened the special section of his tray, the high-class one that contained sausages whose contents were, one, meat, two, from a known four-footed creature, three, probably land-dwelling. "Or may I recommend these gentlemen," he said, and, because old habits died hard, he couldn't stop himself from adding, "finest pork." "Good, are they?" "You'll never want to eat another, sir." The other man said, "about the other sort."
"Pardon?"
"Oves and pig snot and rats what fell in the ing minch, sir." "What Mr. Tulip ear means," said Mr. Pin, "is a more organic sausage."
"Yeah," said Mr. Tulip. "I'm very ing environmental like that."
"Are you sure?" "No, no, fine." Dibbler raised a hand. The manner of the two men had changed. They were clearly very sure of everything.
"Well, you want a bad, a less good sausage, then, "'With ing fingernails in it," said Mr. Tulip. "Well, I do, I could."
Dibbler gave up. He was a salesman.
"You sold what you sold. Let me tell you about these sausages," he went on, smoothly shifting an internal motor into reverse. "When somebody chopped off his thumb in the abattoir, they didn't even stop the grinder. You probably won't find any rat in them, because rats don't go near the place. There's animals in there that, well... You know how they say life began in some kind of big soup? Same with these sausages. If you want a bad sausage, you won't get better than these."
"You keep them for your special customers, do you?" said Mr. Pin.
"To me, sir, every customer is special. And you got mustard."
"People call it mustard," Dibbler began, getting carried away. "But I call it,
I like
"'Ripping mustard,' said Mr. Tulip. "'Really great mustard,' said Dibbler, not missing a beat.
"'We'll take two,' said Mr. Pin. He did not reach for his wallet.
"'On the house,' said Dibbler.
He stunned two sausages, unbunned them, and thrust them forward. Mr. Tulip took both of them and the mustard pot.
"'Do you know what they called a sausage in a bun in Quirm?' said Mr. Pin, as the two walked away.
"'No,'
said Mr. Tulip. "'They called it Le Sausage in Le Bun.'
"'What? In a ing foreign language? You're ing kidding.'
"'I'm not a ing kidder, Mr. Tulip.'
"'I mean, they ought to call it a sausage dans la derrière,'
said Mr. Tulip. He took a bite of his Dibbler Delight.
"'Ay, that's what this ing thing tastes of,'
he added with his mouth full. "'In a bun, Mr. Tulip.'
"'I know what I meant. This is a ing awful sausage.'
Dibbler watched them go. It wasn't often you heard language like that in Ankh-Morpork. Most people talked without leaving gaps in their sentences, and he wondered what the word ing meant.